This is Molly Hemingway, encouraging you to listen to my favorite podcast, Issues, Etc. Every day you get in-depth interviews with host Todd Wilkin asking expert guests substantive, thought-provoking questions on all of the important news and issues of our day. The expert guests are in culture, law, ethics, philosophy, theology, and apologetics. Expert guests, expansive topics, always extolling Christ. Issues, etc.
Truth must be our foundation, and common sense can no longer be an uncommon virtue. In Florida, we proved that it can be done. We chose facts over fear, education over indoctrination, law and order over rioting and disorder. We held the line when freedom hung in the balance. We showed that we can and must revitalize America. We need the courage to lead and the strength to win. I'm Ron DeSantis, and I'm running for president to lead our great American comeback.
That's an excerpt from a video announcing Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' run for president. Well, it's big news because there may be a rival to Donald Trump for the GOP presidential nomination, or maybe not. Nobody really knows. We're in uncharted territory. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Thursday afternoon, the 25th of May. We're going to talk about the GOP presidential race with Mark Hemingway of Real Clear Investigations. We'll spend some time with Delano Squires of the Heritage Foundation discussing law and order as a pro-life issue. We'll go through listener email and the Issues Etc. comment line. Then Sam Brownback, formerly served as an ambassador at large for international religious freedom during the Trump administration, will join us to talk about the U.S. State Department's annual International Religious Freedom Report. Mark Hemingway is a regular guest and senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. Mark, welcome.
Glad to be back.
Picking up on last night's big story, what kind of statement was the DeSantis campaign making by announcing his presidential run on Twitter?
Well, I mean, I think that the clear intention behind it was to announce that they were not going to trust the corporate press to be the gatekeepers of information in this campaign. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious at this point in time they have proven that they cannot be fair to Republican voters time and time again. And so, you know, they were casting about for a novel way to go about making the announcement and certainly doing it on, you know, Elon Musk's Twitter, which purports to be, you know, a new platform that respects free speech, was, you know, sort of a key part of that decision. Obviously, there were some technical glitches and other things like that, but, you know, we'll see how it works out.
It seems as though the glitches are all that the legacy media can focus on, at least this morning. The New York Times called it an embarrassing start on Twitter. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it wasn't great. Obviously, you know, nobody wants their presidential campaign to start with, you know, that kind of attention and focus and to have, you know, a technical meltdown that makes it so that hundreds of thousands of people that wanted to listen in aren't able to, which is, you know, what happened. On the other hand, does anybody even remember how Joe Biden launched his campaign? Do you? I remember it because I'm paid to follow these things. It was basically the release of a video that literally called Republicans, you know, racist. Well, maybe not literally, but I mean, that was basically the effect of it. And I'm not even sure, like, Joe Biden made a big public appearance to do it at the time. But Joe Biden went on to win that race. So I think a couple of things are going on here. One is simply that the press, who actually care about quote-unquote narratives and stuff, and they're way too online to begin with, they might try and make hay out of this, but I don't think it's something that ordinary voters are going to really care about. All they care about is that Ron DeSantis is in and they'll be, you know, following the campaign from here on out. However, having said that, to what extent these failures are emblematic of the campaign organization and whether the campaign organization can run a smooth campaign, you know, we'll see whether this is just an anomaly or this is going to be something that is emblematic of future failures that they have along these lines. But it's way too early to make too much, I think, of the technical glitches.
What were some of the issues highlighted by DeSantis last night?
Well, you know, he talked a lot about wokeism was, you know, a topic that he liked to talk about. He liked to talk about, obviously, his record in Florida. And he's, you know, in general, really sort of concentrating on policy substance, because that's the favorable contrast between him and Trump. It's very interesting. You know, there's a marked contrast here that's being set up here, which is to say that Trump is, you know, very much going after Ron DeSantis personally as, you know, quote unquote, disloyal and all this other stuff. I mean, to some extent, given the way that a lot of Trump supporters feel that the last election went down, they feel kind of like, you know, Trump is owed. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of focus on the personal dynamics from Trump people, and the DeSantis people don't want to take the bait and they want to focus on substance. However, when much of the angst among Republican voters or whatever is, you know, fighting back against the institutions that they see as repressive, like the press and, you know, the federal bureaucracy and things like that, the very people that made it so that Trump couldn't have as successful a presidency as he wanted to, that kind of sort of, you know, personal combativeness and that sort of, you know, ability to personalize things and make it relevant to people is a surprisingly powerful motivator among voters rather than simply focusing on policy competence. You know, obviously, when you start talking about the granular details of COVID policy or this and that, it can also turn off voters. On the other hand, it's also true that part of the reason why Trump wasn't as big a success as he should have been is he didn't seem to have a very good grasp of a lot of policy details. So, you know, it'll be an interesting contrast to watch play out and see how voters respond to the differing approaches.
As a candidate, what are DeSantis's strengths and weaknesses?
Well, I mean, if you look at his governing record in Florida, I mean, to be perfectly blunt, even if you don't like his policies, I'm not sure I've seen a more effective governor in my lifetime. I mean, his ability to work with the Florida legislature and just pass legislation after legislation, you know, advancing, you know, very strong conservative goals, you know, whether it was, I think it was a 6-week abortion ban or this really tough immigration law that they just passed, going after Disney and the bills that would limit what schools can do with gender ideology. I mean, he's really just, you know, moved the ball forward on a wide array of issues across the board and done it really quick. And as he's done that, he's gotten wildly popular in the state. And you got to remember, Florida is not, you know, I mean, it's now considered like crazy red, but I mean, it wasn't that way even just a few years ago. DeSantis squeaked in there with what, like a 10,000 vote margin in a very large, very diverse state. And then, you know, he won by like 1.5-2 million votes for re-election. I mean, I've never seen that kind of turnaround for someone that was narrowly elected before. I mean, it's just absolutely crazy. So clearly he's incredibly competent at governing, and people in the state, they feel the effects of what that's doing for the culture of the state. That, you know, Florida stayed open during COVID. It is, you know, relative amounts of law and order compared to many other parts of the country with large urban areas. It's just really thriving as a result of that. So, you know, that's an obvious, like, huge strength. His big weakness, I think, is people talk about the have a beer with test when it comes to politicians in general. DeSantis can, you know, because he's so good at the policy details and stuff, he can come off almost a little bit like he's Asperger-y or something. Like, you know, he's almost on the spectrum. He can be obsessive about details and things like that. And he's not always the most personable person. I think he's got some good people around him, and his wife in particular is a real strength and asset to him. She seems to be a strong woman and a lovely person, and people like to be around her. The question is, you know, this is true of a lot of political campaigns where they have, like, you know, what they think is a guy who's politically talented, but they have to find ways to humanize him and, you know, coach him to be, you know, a little more natural, because, you know, being a really gregarious, charismatic person, you know, helps get you elected, but it, oftentimes those traits are antithetical to being someone who is good at governing. People are going to talk a lot about that sort of paradox with regard to DeSantis, but it's not like DeSantis is the first guy that's ever had this same struggle. I mean, this is very true of a lot of different politicians that seem to thrive otherwise. They just kind of have to find a way to make sure that they are attentive to the voters, even if they're not naturally inclined to be the most personable guy in the room.
So is it currently a two-person race between DeSantis and Trump?
In the Republican primary, yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes, Tim Scott has jumped in and Nikki Haley's running. And I think Asa Hutchinson, the former governor of Arkansas, is mounting some kind of campaign. But, you know, none of those people are polling at a level that in any way, shape or form seems like it's going to have an impact. Tim Scott is relevant primarily because I think that he would be, you know, near the top of the list of vice presidential selections for either Trump or possibly DeSantis. So his campaign might be worth watching in that regard. But the problem is that all three of those people are like running for the Republican primary in 2012, not 2024. And it's just the political landscape has changed so much, you know, largely thanks to Trump making things much more sort of populist, but also I think just recognizing that a lot of Republican priorities in terms of being corporate friendly and other things like that weren't working out for voters. And certainly foreign policy is another huge issue where Trump completely, you know, captured a huge segment of new voters and crystallized what a lot of Republican base had always been thinking for a long time, that, you know, the Republican Party become too neocon and too like in favor of military adventurism. So I think that the landscape has really changed in such a way that these more conventional Republicans, I don't think that Nikki Haley and Asa Hutchinson in particular are going to be nearly as aligned on foreign policy and economic populism as they need to be to actually capture the Republican base and win a primary. But, you know, it almost doesn't matter because I think they're both polling at like, you know, 1% anyway.
How would you assess Trump's strengths and weaknesses?
Obviously, Trump is a really, truly amazing figure. I mean, I mean that as an almost value-neutral judgment. He acts incredibly intuitively, and it's really amazing how good his instincts were. I mean, the fact that Trump and Trump alone really anticipated this sort of populist realignment that I was just talking about really speaks to something about his character that really connects with Republican voters, and that really can't be discounted. Aside from that, he's kind of a Rain Man for trolling or something like that. I mean, he really knows how to get under the skin of the right people. But the flip side of that is, you know, because he's impulsive and intuitive in general, not every barb or every, you know, shoot from the hip decision works out in his favor, to put it mildly. In fact, you know, he seems to be capable of making judgments and shifting public opinion in ways that no other politician can do so readily. But at the same time, he's also very capable of turning the public and the press against him in ways that could have easily been avoided by other people as well. I don't know what to say about Trump at this point in time. I think most people sort of sense this. I will say that one of his other strengths is simply that, like, in his weird way, for a guy that's a billionaire from Queens who was a Democrat most of his life, he's done a really great job of expressing patriotism and an actual genuine connection to sort of blue collar Americans and, you know, people in the Rust Belt and other things like that. I mean, it's really, really strange how good he is at sort of feeling their pain, to borrow the Bill Clinton term. So we'll see whether that, you know, magical connection with voters persists as the campaign goes on.
Is President Trump vulnerable on issues like education reform and LGBTQA+ and the COVID response with Republican voters?
We're going to have to sort of wait and see on this, but yeah, it's entirely possible. There has been some sort of signals on some of this stuff like abortion and other issues where it seems like the Trump people are really going to try and avoid some of the hot button culture war issues and sort of stay above that. I don't know whether that's a strategy or not. I mean, if you look at all of the transsexual stuff and the Bud Light culture wars, things that are going on, I mean, dealing with these issues might be unavoidable. If the average voter can't go to Target without having sexual politics shoved into their face, then it seems to me like it's going to be very hard for, you know, Trump to sort of like sidestep this, unless he can just kind of convince people that he's implicitly on their side. Whereas DeSantis has really taken on these issues, you know, head on, and certainly he's going to be sort of drawing a contrast with that. So I just don't know how the culture war issues are, you know, necessarily going to play out, but it's going to be a really interesting contrast to watch.
Mark Hemingway is our guest. He's senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. We're talking about the GOP presidential race. On the other side, how does he expect DeSantis to respond to Trump's personal attacks?
America's tradition of liberty depends on having colleges and universities that equip young people for the responsibilities of freedom. At Concordia University Chicago, freedom is a pillar of our education. We prepare our students to live as free, self-governing citizens. I'm Dr. Rachel Ferguson, director of the Free Enterprise Center at Concordia Chicago. I invite you to visit us. Discover what it means for freedom to become a pillar of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
Terry Mattingly is the eternal boomer. In other words, he, due to the circumstances of his birth, is lame.
Here's some feedback from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Terry can be counted on to deliver his boring, blasé takes in his irritatingly pseudo-profound fashion. Anyway, lame. May God have mercy on Terry and Issues Etc. You're all a bunch of lame boomers.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Lutheranism in the public square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
You wish your classical school could do more for struggling learners, uncertain where to begin? The Memoria Press Schools Division includes Cheryl Swope, author of Simply Classical, A Beautiful Education for Any Child. The Schools Division will happily assist your school. Memoria Press offers an entire line of special needs resources for teaching math, reading, spelling, and more. Contact schools at memoriapress.com or order directly from simplyclassical.com with coupon code LPR23.
Not everyone is comfortable with new technology. Dial A Podcast gives all generations of your congregation an easy way to hear your sermons or even devotionals and Bible studies. Once you've completed a simple one-time setup, we take care of the rest. All your congregants have to do is dial the number from any phone to listen to your latest podcast, all at no additional cost to them. Dial A Podcast. Extend the reach of your sermons. Get started at dialapodcast.com now.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the GOP presidential race with Mark Hemingway of Real Clear Investigations. So, Mark, how do you expect DeSantis to respond to Trump's personal attacks that are already underway?
Yeah, for DeSantis, this is what was the Star Trek thing about the Kobayashi Maru, the game where the only winning move is not to play. Aside from the fact that, you know, DeSantis doesn't have anywhere near Trump's sort of personal charisma in that regard, he doesn't benefit at all from attacking Trump because, again, his personally or getting into the mud with him, because personally his strength is, you know, again, on competence and, you know, policy substance. And frankly, his pitch to voters is going to be, yeah, I'm Trump without the baggage. If he were to get in the mud with Trump on the personal attacks and stuff like that, it would be, you know, suggestive of the fact that DeSantis is willing to take on Trump's baggage and do so without sort of the charm of Trump when he does that sort of thing. So DeSantis is going to try very hard, I think, not to take the bait. And I think that's the smartest move for him. And, you know, on top of that, as long as he can focus the conversation on policy and other things, I mean, you know, he benefits from that contrast. And, you know, Trump did not make great decisions with regard to COVID. You know, he trusted Fauci. He did all these other things that are going to resonate if the, you know, public conversation can stay focused on those things as long as it needs to. And they can, you know, keep the press and then the conversation among voters focused on those issues rather than whatever insult and meme Trump is throwing around.
Is it conceivable that Trump can be beaten?
I think so, although it's going to be something I think that is going to happen under the radar. I should be clear, I don't think it's likely at this point in time that Trump will be beaten, but there was a really interesting story in the New York Times a day or so ago about how, first of all, DeSantis is really good at raising money, and he's got a fairly large war chest. And so far, they have, you know, a $200 million war chest or something just to run in the primaries. And they have a big plan to invest in campaign infrastructure and in primary states in a way that Trump has never even conceived of. Trump won elections with, you know, won a savvy digital campaign combined with his personal charm and charisma dominating the news and other stuff like that. Trump never had like the sort of on the ground campaign organization that he really needed to thrive. And frankly, not having that on the ground organized campaign organization is one reason why he lost in 2020. I mean, he lost, you know, so narrowly in just a handful of states that, you know, having a slightly better campaign organization to turn out votes would have been, you know, huge for him. So DeSantis is already looking to correct that and sort of beat Trump at that game. So one of the big plans announced in the New York Times story was they have this plan to just do old-fashioned door knocking. And their whole goal is to like literally knock on every potential DeSantis voter's door in the early primary states like New Hampshire and Iowa, like four or five times between now and when those primary election and caucuses are. So if he can do that, if he can convince enough people in early primary states that, and he polls favorable in those states, which, you know, tend, you know, like Iowa and New Hampshire, which tend to be, you know, maybe a little bit more moderate Republican or full of people that are maybe more inclined going to be tired of Trump's shtick. If he can have a really great showing in those early primary states and demonstrate early on that, you know, Trump can be beaten in one or two of those primaries, then it's game on. I still think in terms of, you know, everything from like basic name recognition to, you know, Trump just being such a dominant political figure, that Trump is likely to win. But counting DeSantis out at this point in time would be like just a massive mistake. I think that he's got a smart strategy and, you know, there's a lot of time between now and then.
It was announced yesterday that President Trump has a trial date in the criminal case in New York. And the judge looks like he's going to make Trump be there for that trial. Will him sitting in a courtroom in New York City make a difference in the middle of the primary season?
To the primary, I don't think it's going to make any difference at all. Like I said, I don't know. I mean, if the court case spirals way out of control and for some reason he can't be out in the field for weeks at a time, you know, campaigning, you know, I guess that might be a little bit of a different story. But honestly, at this point in time, so many of the things that have been raised against Trump as a matter of procedure, whether it was the Mar-a-Lago documents raid or whether it was the first impeachment or the Mueller report and all these other things, so many of these procedural things that have been used against Trump have been shown to have serious problems and be heavily politicized at a minimum. And in some cases, like the Trump-Russia stuff and other things, you know, to be like utterly meritless. And so I don't think that Republican voters in particular are going to look at Trump being in a courtroom and see anything other than yet another unfair tribunal that Trump is being dragged into. So I don't think that's going to matter. Will that kind of thing matter more in a general election where you're going to have a lot more people voting who are just maybe sick of the Trump fatigue? I mean, I think part of what's going on here is Democrats just have this strategy with Trump, which is to just turn the volume up on all of the controversy so much, no matter how meritless, to the point where people just are voting to turn the volume back down and get somebody else in there just so they don't have to deal with all of the drama. It's a pretty terrible way to go about politics, but I think it worked in 2020. I mean, to the point that they, you know, we even had like nationwide riots being blamed on Trump when he had nothing to do with it. So I don't know. We'll see.
Who else do you expect to enter the race for the GOP nomination?
Aside from the people that have already entered, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's some talk about Glenn Youngkin and one of these other more moderate Republican governors getting in if they think that there's a moderate lane, because DeSantis, for all his, for being the more moderate version of Trump, is still considered to be farther out on the right. But I think that most of those people in that position have really determined there isn't a lane there already, although Youngkin, it might be testing the waters a little.
What about Mike Pence?
Mike Pence is just a non-entity at this point in time. I mean, yeah, he's going to run, I think, but I don't think he goes anywhere. Nobody has much interest in him at this point in time.
The GOP head has indicated that one of the stipulations for partaking in the GOP primary debates will be signing a pledge not to go third party. Do you think Trump will sit out those debates?
No, I don't think he'll necessarily sit out those debates, but who knows? We have a whole problem with the presidential debate infrastructure, period, which is to say that, you know, we can't have another election where we have corporate media moderators. I mean, they're just simply not trustworthy. It was disastrous in the last election. Trump, I suppose, could get away with refusing to participate in the debates, depending on who's involved. But I think the Republican establishment is smart enough to know that they can't just trot out some, you know, corporate media host and expect Republicans to participate in the debate. On the other hand, signing a pledge may not mean much to Trump. I mean, he might sign a pledge just to be in the debate and then decide later he's going to run third party anyway. Now, I don't think people are, he's going to care that much about holding to a pledge. And I don't think people are going to care much that he didn't hold to that pledge, especially not his most enthusiastic supporters.
Mark Hemingway is a senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. You'll find a link to his columns on the Talk On Demand Archives page at issuesetc.org. Mark, thanks.
Thank you.
When we come back, it's listener email and the Issues Etc. comment line. When defending a biblical doctrine or practice, have you ever been accused of not caring for the lost? I've written a column in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Playing the Mission Card. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Jeremy Lamont recounts his slow and sometimes painful path out of Mormonism to the Lutheran confession. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, is looking for an English teacher with a master's degree for the 2023-24 school year. Edwardsville is 30 minutes from downtown St. Louis. The position would involve teaching upper-level, dual-credit English classes. For more information, send an email to Principal Jay Krause, J-A-Y-K-R-A-U-S-E, at melhs.org, jkrause@melhs.org.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you heard the rumblings about the 68th Convention of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? Well, it's coming up this summer in Milwaukee. In convention, LCMS delegates comprised of both laity and clergy gather for worship, study of God's Word, and to discuss and vote on the business of Synod. For a preview of what's coming up, pick up a copy of the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness, cph.org to subscribe to the magazine, or witness.lcms.org to learn more. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Confessional Lutherans are invited to rent a 4-bedroom, 3-bathroom Table Rock lakefront home in the Ozarks. Table Rock Lake is a premier lake in the heart of the Ozarks for boating, water sports, and fishing. This log cabin-style rental sleeps 12 and is 30 minutes from Branson and 20 minutes from Silver Dollar City. Learn more by calling Swanson Estates, 713-855-2681. Be sure to mention Issues Etc., 713-855-2681.